Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
My name is Wendy Su. I am an associate professor at Media and Cultural Studies Department from University of California at Riverside.
And Professor Wendy, it's a great honor and a privilege to be talking to you. We just spent a couple of moments chatting, and it's been such a long time, but I've missed talking to you, and I'm really delighted that we're back together to have a conversation.
Yeah, Toby, it's so great to see you again. Thanks for having me here, and it's a great honor to join this Cultural Studies podcast. It's my pleasure.
Well, it's exciting for me. So, Prof. Wendy, I wanted to begin by asking you about what is currently interesting you, preoccupying you, worrying you, exciting you. What's going on? What seems important right now?
Okay. You know, I can answer this question from different levels. I think at my personal level or at an individual research level, I am preoccupied by my next book project and research. So I've been always thinking of the direction of my upcoming research. So this is one thing that preoccupied me. And at the larger picture, at a higher level, the thing that most worried me is geopolitical tension, and especially the U.S.-China relation,
Yes.
How this relation will affect the geopolitics and how this relation will affect the people's livelihood of both countries, both in American and China, and also the entire world. You know, the U.S. is the largest economy in the world, and China is number two. So if number one, number two cannot get along, the entire world will be affected. So actually, I'm very worried about the direction of geopolitics. So I think I can answer this question from the two different level. One is from individual level and one from the larger picture.
Yes, I appreciate your distinguishing the two levels, though sometimes they can combine because you're a Chinese woman living in the United States. So
Yes.
you are experiencing some of this personally, no doubt. Perhaps we could talk about your next research project in a moment. But for now, I wanted to ask you about those geopolitical tensions. And one of the big issues at the moment is TikTok and
Yes.
ownership of TikTok. What is this controversy really about? Why is this
Oh.
such a problem in the United States?
You know, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure I'm capable to answer that question, but I will try because I'm not a digital media expert. My previous research is on film and cultural industry, but I will try to answer this question. I think the central issue about TikTok is not about digital technology per se. It's just about national interest or national safety for American. And I believe American, or would say the U.S. government, is very concerned about this national security issue, and it actually, from my point of view, is exaggerating the danger, a threat posed by TikTok. I think TikTok is so popular among the world audience, especially among the younger generation in the United States. But the U.S. congressman seems to use TikTok as a tool to exaggerate the China threat and try to ban this new technology. That's my understanding.
It does seem that way. And in terms of broader questions, geopolitical tensions, are there misunderstandings on both sides? Is there a misunderstanding about China on the part of the US? Is there a misunderstanding about the US on the part of China? Or is it that their interests diverge and this causes the tension?
I would say the United States and China have entirely different political systems, political belief, and ideology. So I think the conflict clash at any point of the past historical period are all inevitable because the two countries are so different in terms of their political systems, political beliefs, and ideologies. So I think the crucial thing is how the two countries manage their conflict not to escalate. And I agree that I think probably both countries have in the past misunderstood the other side. Probably there exists some misunderstanding. Maybe I would say this issue is very complicated. Probably they all actually misunderstood the other country's motives, maybe, and a social atmosphere and the society dynamics in each country, and especially during the pandemic period, I think the pandemic probably contributes too much of.
Yes, and there was a lot of anti-Chinese racism in the United States. Well, there has been for nearly 200 years, but especially during the pandemic, right? It was pretty bad, I think.
Yes.
And
And I think from the perspective of United States, I think United States seems seems I mean always how would I say always actually changed from one extreme to another extreme. So it's always, in the past it believed that China is moving in the direction it hoped. But when it says China is not moving in the direction it hoped, then it quickly changes its attitude and exaggerate it exaggerates the China threat and misunderstands China's situation. And from the perspective of Chinese government, it also actually, I think, miscalculate its own real social reality. You some maybe misjudge the situation leading to this a worrying situation now.
Definitely. So, returning to your next project, Professor Wendy, I wonder if you could tell us roughly what you're thinking of embarking on for the next book.
I'm still working on my next book, so and I haven't finished maybe the majority part of it, so maybe I can only roughly generally talk about the idea.
Of
My
course.
next book project is about Chinese youth culture. Youth culture. Actually, but this is not for the youth culture per se. I try to explore the larger question and the larger problematics behind this youth culture. So I try to use the case study of Chinese youth culture to analyze the future direction of China and to analyze the issue that concerning China for many, many years. That
Wow.
is the path toward China's modernization. And how Chinese youth is caught among the different winds, different direction. So this project is about the Chinese youth struggle during a transitional period. It's also about how the next generation or the future generations of China will face a very unpredictable and uncertainty of the world, and how their struggle will shape the country's future.
These are massive questions. That's
I
really
agree.
impressive.
agree. That's why, I'm struggled with this because it's those questions are all in my mind because when I do some research, I never only think about this research subjects per se. I always think about the as a Chinese American and a Chinese living in America, I always think about how the country, the biggest developing country in the world, should move forward, and what kind of force can shape this country's future, and also can affect the world. So the Chinese generations are the future of the country. What they stand for will speak for the future of China. So maybe these are very big questions. So I'm still not sure how to answer these questions, but these questions are always in my mind.
And could you tell us, Professor, a little bit about which aspects of youth culture you're focusing on?
Which aspect? Actually, I try to provide a very comprehensive pictures because Chinese youth is not a homogeneous group. It's very divided and polarized, I would say, to some extent. They are very polarized. Some of them showing strong feeling of nationalism, and others are showing maybe other tendencies, for example, the subculture, the life light, and maybe a very negative feeling. And others still trying to figure out the correct path for China to move forward. Some of them are very idealists, idealist, and some others are just very negative rebellious. So showing civil liberties, showing civil obedience, disobedience. So I try to provide the comprehensive picture and charting, maybe try my best to incorporate every aspect. Maybe that's not comprehensive enough, but I'm trying.
And could you tell us a little bit about how you're doing this? Is it by watching film? Is it by doing ethnographic research in China? Is it talking to people? What are your ways of going about the
Yeah,
study?
I understand this is a research methodology issue, right? If you we use the academic jargon, right? So I think for different chapters, I use different resources as method. Sometimes I use the online chat room, online community. So use digital ethnographic way. Especially for those topics that is difficult for me to get access to the real subjects. And for other, I do ethnographic. I interview people. I do in-depth interview. And especially I would say my favorite research methods is focus groups. So I already organized a number, I would say a dozen of focus groups, and invite young Chinese, some of them college students, I would say most of them are college students, to come to talk. And for some other idealists, people, I do in-depth interview. So I talk to people, mainly it's ethnographic, but I also use online digital resources and books, maybe some documents and other media reports.
And what have you discovered so far that has surprised you? Are there things that you've learned in the focus groups or the in-depth interviews that have really amazed you? Or has it been what you'd expected?
I would see the mo I would see I feel very, very saddened and shocked by how depressed the Chinese youth is now. Yeah, because I feel their political dreams have been shattered, And after experiencing the lockdowns, especially after Shanghai lockdown, I would say before the Shanghai lockdown, especially in the year of 2021, the entire Chinese mood, especially Chinese youth mood, was actually at the peak of nationalism because they really believed that China did a good job in controlling COVID-19. And China's economy, actually, the GDP growth reached even 7.7% in 2029. So the entire Chinese people's mood was actually very, very optimistic in the year of 2021. However, this nationalism mood actually underwent a dramatic downturn after Shanghai lockdown. That happening starting from the March 2022. So starting from April, March and April of 2022, the entire country's mood actually show a dramatic downturn. And especially after 1 year, the strict draconian lockdown and the Shanghai lockdown, the people's, especially younger generation's mood has changed a lot. I was so shocked and saddened when I interviewed. I organized almost maybe five focus group and talked to a lot of Chinese students. I was so saddened by how depressed and how negative of their mood. So I feel so worried. And you know, some of them. And according to statistics, millions of Chinese youth actually have showed a symptom of depression, because they spent 3 years in lockdown. This thing has never happened in any human history in lockdown. So their entire middle school year or high school year are all in lockdown. This severely affect their mentality. You know what? The most shocking word I heard from youth is that I asked them what's their wish for the future. And one of them even answered, "Our generation's only wish is to die a normal death." That's so shocking. I was so shocked and saddened by their responses. So that's the thing I can see. But on the other hand, on the positive side, there are still some Chinese youth, they are cherish their dream to rebuild the country and to promote world peace. Though, so they are still experimenting with, excuse me, experimenting with every method to try to figure out what they should do. They should do. So there are still some idealists, for example, some rural rebuilders. They are still deeply rooted in the Chinese reality and try to figure out the best way to rebuild country. So this some very bright spot, and I'm moved by them. So I try to, in my upcoming book project, I try to incorporate all the aspects. Some of them actually complain a lot, very negative, but others still are very idealistic. They try to move forward.
And Prof, before becoming a scholar, you were a journalist. Could
Yes.
you tell us a little bit about what it's like interviewing people as a professor, as a researcher, as opposed to interviewing people as a journalist? Are they similar? Are they different? Do they require the same sorts of skills? Or are they quite distinct as tasks?
Oh. Bobby, I think this is a very good question and interesting question. I would say my experience of being a journalist is in the past, it has helped me to develop my in-depth interview techniques. But the major difference between the two types of interviews is, as a journalist, when you interview people, you just ask relatively. I mean, how can I can put this? A relatively straightforward question defined by the current interview requirement assigned by your editor, right? But if you interview people as a scholar, then you try to figure out the deep-rooted reason behind their phenomenon, especially during the focus group. But I will try to dig further and further and push them to answer their maybe subconscious thinking, and try to push them to discover all this, and also try to incite the in group interaction to encourage, to stimulate, to think. And in my mind, I am guided by the larger question in my mind. So not just a simple and straightforward journalistic question that assigned by your editor. I would say that.
And of course, these things have different temporalities. The deadline as a journalist might be tonight or next week. The
Yes.
deadline as a scholar might be 2 years from now.
Yes. But I remember when we were colleagues, so you mentioned to me that scholar work spend a lot of time working on a book, but when the book is out, it's quickly outdated. So I think that's a question also concerning me. So I think when my book is out, maybe they change, the Chinese views change. Maybe may have changed. So what's the use of my book?
Well, I understand what you're saying. On the other hand, things that are historical can be of great value, even if they're of the very recent past. And even if they're not correct panoramas of the present, they may still shed light on what's happening in the here and now, if they're read well. And speaking of this, I'm taken back to your first book, a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you, Toby.
That is historical and contemporary in that it came out 7 or 8 years ago. And it was about the moment of the opening up of the Chinese market to Hollywood from the mid-1990s up until just before you wrote the book, middle of the 2010s, and you're looking at cultural policy, cultural exchange, economic issues, and political issues. So, for people who may not know the book, I wonder if you could just outline a little bit about the things that you do in the book, the things that you found out.
Okay, for my first book, I mainly did a historical documentary analysis. Oh, I also interviewed some people, but it's different from my upcoming project. So I mainly analyzed government policy towards the global Hollywood, and also how Hollywood helped shaped the China's culture industry, especially film industry. And also in one chapter, I also did some interview and also did some audience research, so that Chinese audience responded to Hollywood imperialism or Hollywood culture globalization, etc. So that's the mainly historical documentary analysis, and actually charting the entire trajectory of China's encounter with global Hollywood, and also trying to situate China in the peak of globalization. And so trying use this China's encounter with Hollywood as a case study to try to shed some light on the development of China's culture industry and also China's culture modernization.
And what happens? What's different between the early 1990s and 20 years later? What has happened during that period in the relationship between Hollywood and China?
A lot have happened. So the relationship between Hollywood and China, I've written several articles, actually quite a number of articles, charting all the latest developments. So at the beginning, China actually was a student of Hollywood. To learn from Hollywood, because China's film industry was just actually transitioning from a state-planned economy to a market-based economy, so it need to learn. So, but during the encounter with global Hollywood, China has learned a lot and tried to modernize its film industry. Now, the Hollywood began to collaborate China and to merge into the huge market. Then China became the Hollywood's money machine, because Hollywood heavily relies on Chinese market to make money. So at some point that China and Asian Pacific market even becomes the biggest box office contributor to Hollywood's revenue. So that's is it. And now, then after 2017, I would say the first half of 2017 marked peak of the China Hollywood collaboration. Both sides needs each other. The Hollywood needs Chinese market, and China needs Hollywood's talent, film techniques, etc., and the network, promotional network. And however, after Trump administration assumed the office, their relationship actually dropped to maybe the iciest point they ever had. And now, because of this slowing China's economy and the shrinking market, and also because of the COVID-19, that the most people now get used to live streaming, streamlining of the movies, they do not go to the cinema anymore, and also becomes the intensified geopolitics and bilateral relations. Their relation now, I think, has come to a stalemate. Yeah. So, in thousand Los Angeles, there were once a U.S.-China film summit every year, but after Trump assumed office, they changed the title to U.S.-Asians Film Summit because they believe that if you add China is too politically sensitive and it's not right, so they changed that summit, and they never resumed that U.S.-China summit. And now the collaboration began to always almost collapse, but still recent development showing some signs that the Chinese company is still trying to march into the overseas market, especially the American market. But the collaboration now, I think, came to a stop.
Fascinating, really, really, really fascinating. I know that a lot of Congress people, both Democrats and Republicans, have complained about Hollywood censoring itself in order to satisfy the Chinese government. And Hollywood has actually always done this. It censored itself to satisfy the US government, the British government, you name it. Right, to deal with censorship laws about drugs, about sex, about politics, about religion, all sorts of things. It's always done this. But there is a real obsession with having to remove certain sequences that it is thought, perhaps rightly, will give offense to the Chinese Communist Party. And you will have seen the letters written by members of Congress about this
Yes,
kind of
I've seen that.
obsessed detailing of these changes that have been made.
Yes,
But,
I agree.
really, really interesting. So, go
May
ahead.
I add that there was a recently published article in the Top Journal of American Sociology Review, that detailing how transnational cooperation, the film corporation actually self-censored themselves and try to actually change all those production procedure.
Oh,
So there
really?
are
Gee, I
some.
must look for that. Thank you.
Yes.
China and Hollywood, American Sociological Review.
American Sociological Review.
Yep. Okay. I hope I can find that. Oh, is this by Jun Fang?
Yes. I think the writer.
Yes. Got it. He's writing a book called When China Meets Hollywood, it says.
Let me double check. I can send you that article. Okay.
Thank you. Anyway, I appreciate it. This is fascinating. So, after your monograph came out, your book on your own, you then co-edited a book on you got the message about things having to be about Asia and not just China.
Yes.
Per the collapse of the Hollywood China annual meeting. No, but in all seriousness, you then broadened your approach to look at the Asia Pacific region in general, in terms of elements of collaboration,
Yes.
specifically through co-productions. Now, this is a complex term, the co-production. And its meaning can vary from country to country and treaty to treaty and time to time. But I wonder for people who've maybe not come across this concept, whether you could explain what a co-production is when it comes to film.
Oh, you know, the co-production seems different. Countries and different people have a different definition, right? So in some countries or some definition, as long as you collaborate in terms of personnel, cost, money, in some way, they can all call it co. They can all be co-productions, right? But the Chinese government had its own definition. So it tried to actually remodel the co-production to suit its own needs. So that co-production requires at least a certain amount of the Chinese money, Chinese cost, Chinese labor. So that's different. So what's the common definition for co-production, Toby? You are the expert.
Well, I guess it's an interesting question. What is the definition? Sometimes it's about a specific treaty or accord that is signed between two countries and that then governs the way in which arrangements are made for the making of film, or it might be television drama. Sometimes it's multilateral. Think about the European Union, for example, and the way in which it might provide funding and some administration for co-productions involving a number of member states across Europe. Sometimes, and this is the way it tends to be used in the United States, it doesn't involve treaties signed between countries, but rather it's an arrangement between, say, a government, a provincial or a national government in another country, and a Hollywood studio, or a production company that has a distribution deal with a Hollywood studio. And so the US understanding of it tends to be less about what happens between one government and another than is the case with other countries. I think that's true.
Okay, so from this point of view, that the co-production really has different understandings, different, and China has not signed up treaty for a num with a number of countries, but they're still making co-productions. That's a kind of
Yes,
arrangement.
that can happen. That's right.
Yes.
That's right, because of this complex definition. Yeah, exactly. And And yet, at a certain level, we sort of understand what's meant by it, the term, right? Even
Yes.
though it's got all these different meanings, people tend to be able to comprehend what it is being referred to. So anyway, I mean, it's a very complex story. When you were editing the book, what was that like as opposed to your experience of writing a book or writing journal articles? Some people refer to editing a book as being like herding cats, trying to bring cats to behave the same way. What was it like for you co-editing your book?
I think the experience of editing a book is very different from writing a book, because writing a book is your own task. It's own task. But editing a book is more important to coordinate with your co-editor, with the a number of other contributors. So I think editor is more in the sense of collaboration, coordinating, and also trying to figure out what kind of topic most suitable to the general theme of the edited book. And you have to figure out, and you have to collaborate with a dozen of writers. So I think that's a lot of work of coordination. For me, maybe I would rather write a book. But I thank Toby, you also contributed a chapter, right?
Yes, well, you and your co-editor made it better, and you were both very kind to invite me. So, Prof, I have one more question for you, if I may. And then, after I've asked you the question and you've responded, I'd like to ask you whether there are things you wish to add to what we've discussed as a way of concluding our recording. Yeah? It may be there are things that we haven't touched on about your research that you'd like to emphasize. Yeah? If not, fine. But
Okay.
my last question for you is, in a way, a personal one, but it does get back to some of the things you began with. I wonder if you could talk about what it's been like for you as a Chinese person over the last many years living in the United States, what your experiences have been like in terms of race and gender, xenophobia, and so on. Because you've described ebbs and flows in the relationship between the United States and China. What's that been like for you?
I personally, to be honest, I think maybe because most of the time I spend in universities. So I think most of American university professors are very conscious, very conscientious. So I feel I have been treated fairly and well, especially in my universities where I graduated, University of Minnesota. I think I was grateful for them because I was treated fairly there, and all professors are great. So I think at a personal level, maybe because most of the time I live around universities, they are well-educated people. So maybe they have racism, but they do not show up. Maybe they do not show up. So I feel I still feel there are a lot of very intelligent, wise, and good people in this country. But I also feel the difference between politicians and professors and conservatives and liberals. Because most of the time I worked with liberals and the lefts, they are nice people. They are good people with the political consciences. So most time I worked with them. In my life, I really interact with conservatives, far right. So I personally cannot feel how they think. But so this is my personal level. But later, the longer I live in the United States, the deeper I feel the racism and the conservatives and the right wings. Subconscious, they're deeply rooted racism. You know, at the beginning, yeah, as international students, I do not feel that way because the university professors, most of them are liberals and the left-wing intellectuals. So they are progressive. They are very progressive. So I do not personally feel that way. But the longer I live in this country, the deeper I can feel that the white supremacy and the racism are actually deeply rooted in a lot of people's heart, mind and heart. Maybe, and you can sense the subtleties. That's very subtle. I can sense the subtleties. Maybe they do not show, they do not reveal, but I can still sense that subtleties. So I would say this way. And especially, the longer I live in this country, the deeper I feel the flaws of US system. I really feel that way, the flaws. Because the US democracy is not what it claimed. It a lot flaws. And also the system sometimes does not work at all. For example, the election of the far right groups, right? So it's not so. Some of my actually the previous schoolmates very honestly and openly said, so after COVID, their image, their sense of American completely shattered, completely shattered, because they underwent the chaos happening in this society. They feel their good perception of American society has been completely shattered. So they do feel, because our generation, as the 1980s Chinese college students, our mind and thoughts were deeply influenced by all those open door policy. So by that time, the US is not a source, it's kind of a source of democracy, inspiration, something. But after so many years, we feel the flaws of this system. We really feel the flaws. So we're always trying to figure out what's the right direction for the world.
I very much appreciate your frankness in answering that. So, Prof, for us to conclude, I wonder if there are things that we haven't discussed that you'd like to mention, or whether there are issues we have touched on where you'd like to elaborate. And then once we finish recording, you and I can gossip. We can talk some more. But for now, in terms of this episode of the podcast, is there further material you'd like to touch on?
I really want to ask you, since this is a culture studies podcast, right, Toby? So I want to ask you this question. What is culture studies after all? Because, right now, things I'm doing, Chinese youth, the subculture, there's the question of what is culture studies actually always hung in my mind, because a lot of people doing a lot of different subjects. And I remember when I started to teach culture studies at UC Riverside, and once you give us the junior faculty members list of what is culture studies, and you say these are all culture studies, or what is not culture studies. But in China and in some other countries, a lot of culture scholars come from the literary criticism background. So they mainly did just the textual analysis, that culture, literary critique, something. So I often feel very confused. What is culture study exactly? My understanding of culture study probably is a little old-fashioned because my training is from British culture studies, from university communication programs, from Lawrence Grossberg's tradition, right? And from British culture study. So culture studies for me is a kind of following the Raymond Williams, the definition of culture study. It's the ordinary people's life. Culture is ordinary, right? Culture should not be the elite, the kind of literary criticism. But anyway, so would you maybe elaborate for me, since you are the expert in this kind, in this aspect.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm the expert, but it is funny you ask, Prof, because just a few hours ago, I gave an interview on Spanish television where I was asked, what is cultural studies?
Yes.
So I do have a prepared answer, as it were. But look, I think the tradition that you studied and that you reference is a very important one for everybody involved in cultural studies. Larry's work, William's example, and others from the so-called British New Left, Stuart Hall, Julian Mitchell, and later people like Angela McRobbie and Charlotte Brunston, David Morley, Dick Hebdige. But there is another tradition that comes from the decolonizing forces of Africa, Aimé Césaire, of Latin America, Néstor García Cantilini, from Asia, Anthony Fung, where those influences from the UK are important, including Marxism and semiotics, textual criticism, but so can be political struggle, political economy, and one's own creativity. Think of Anthony as someone who is a clothes designer and a radio guy, as well as a writer of cultural studies. So I think those alternative regional and national traditions need to be included. And of course, in terms of what it's about, I did give you guys that list that I had constructed as a heuristic device for people to get a sense what's in it, what's not in it. Because for people who say they're doing cultural studies, who nevertheless need to get jobs within conventional disciplines, it can be useful to show to people who are botanists or ecologists or literary critics what the relationships are to other disciplines. But I think the two elements that tend to connect people who say, I do cultural studies, are identity and power. And the identity might be national, class, gender, race, sexual, age, etc. The way in which you are categorized by religion or these other elements, the way you see yourself. And also the question of power, power in two senses, in the terms understood by Isaiah Berlin, negative freedom, freedom from being obliged to do something, the old liberal notion of what is freedom, and the more Marxist revolutionary tradition of positive freedom, freedom to be able to have a comfortable life, have lots of leisure time, be free from illness and so on. So I think those elements are what together connect the tissue of cultural studies, with an important aspect being what's popular, understood in two senses, what is economically popular in market terms, but also what emerges from the popular classes, from everyday people. And that in turn necessitates a tripartite approach to analysis. One is about meaning, where and how meaning is created, textual analysis, content analysis, and their kind. The second is political economy. What are the relationships of states, corporations, unions, churches, different institutions, and their economic concerns? And then the third is ethnographic. What are the experiences of people working in, say, the culture industries, or the experiences of people who are audiences there too? So that's my slightly lengthy answer.
I think culture studies should not be equivalized with the study of culture, because culture studies has its very distinct political mission, right? And especially emphasizing on power relations and structure imbalance, social inequality, I believe so. And so I think, especially maybe in China or in some other parts, a lot of culture studies come from literary criticism. Can literary criticism be considered culture studies, part of culture studies?
Well, I guess it's the case that in many countries, language disciplines, French, English, comparative literature in the United States, have been important points of origin for these questions. But there's also been a more philosophical and social science related tradition, which comes more from communication studies, represented by Larry and others. But there are certainly people who've been trained as literary critics who would regard themselves as doing cultural studies. Think of at the University of Minnesota, someone like Timothy Brennan, or at NYU, someone like Andrew Ross. But there would also be someone who studied with Larry, like John Ernie in Hong Kong, who also studied law and aspects of medicine and human rights, who would see himself as cultural studies. So I think there is a particular turn that's been taken that makes it a bit safer and a bit less political and more literary. Yes.
Okay, so now the field of culture studies becomes broader and broader.
I'm afraid so, but on the other hand, it tends not to be an institution that sets out, for example, to draw kinship lines in the way that anthropology does. It tends not to describe the totality of everyday life and the structures that imbue that life with meaning. It tends to focus more on struggle, on crisis, on moments of conflict. And that's the political bit that I think you were emphasizing.
Yes, I always believe cultural studies should be critical.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you very much, Professor. It's been wonderful chatting to you. I really appreciate it, and especially for your coming up with that provocative last contribution. And I'm sure listeners will enjoy this and benefit from it greatly.
It's my pleasure, Toby, and thanks for having me.